abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Friday, January 10th, 2014. Tom Woods here, and we are smacking down government propaganda Monday through Friday, noon Eastern at TomWoodsRadio.com. And then as a podcast on iTunes or wherever you like to get your podcasts. I hope you guys got to see my video dealing with Mark Levin. I did not want to do this. I don't have time lately to do things like this, but I had to after all the names he's been calling people. And basically, he's also been insulting Judge Andrew Napolitano. I mean, come on. I mean, even his own supporters have to say at this point, he really is acting like a, well, I almost called him a name, but my principle is I don't return his name calling. But if you didn't see that video, you can go over to YouTube, type in Woods Levin debate, or it would be up on my website, on my blog at tomwoods.com. But let's get that ugliness out of our minds right now, shall we? I'll also direct you, though, let's keep the ugliness in our minds for just one more moment. Let me direct you to the special educational page I made up for Mark Levin. I want you to look at it. The special educational page, where else am I going to educate him but libertyclassroom.com? So libertyclassroom.com/Levin. Check that out. You're going to find that amusing. You're going to like the resources that are there. So please do that. Today, though, I am very glad to welcome to the program Steve Silverman. Steve Silverman is the founder and executive director of Flex Your Rights, which is all about educating you on your rights during police encounters. But more recently, we also see Steve talking about jury nullification, which is going to be the subject of a new movie that he's starting up. He's also produced two other educational movies, Busted, The Citizen's Guide to Surviving Police Encounters, and 10 Rules for Dealing with Police. Check out Flex Your Rights at flexyourrights.org. And also follow them on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the community. Steve Silverman, thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
First of all, can you tell us about what Flex Your Rights is all about? What can people expect to find when they go to flexyourrights.org?
Sure. The mission of flexyourrights.org is really very simple. Our mission is to educate people about how to assert their constitutional rights during police encounters and other encounters with law enforcement and the criminal justice system. And when folks go to our website, they'll learn, they'll see videos, they'll see articles about what to do in just about any situation you can imagine dealing with a police encounter under the sun. We've got a very detailed frequently asked questions section where, just about anything involving canines, how to record the police, what to do if police are knocking at your door.
What to do when there's a bear cat outside my house.
Exactly. We really try to get as specific as possible with our FAQs. And of course, these are frequently asked questions. And so if we get the question just once, we'll wait till we at least get it like two or three times before we make it into an FAQ page.
Now, I noticed that you've got a piece up summarizing a panel that you were on the subject of jury nullification. Now, is that your specialization within Flex Your Rights, or are you sort of a jack of all trades?
Oh, I'm a layperson, and so really, and I've been doing this work for about 10 years or so. And so what I find with Flex Your Rights, what I try to identify are places within the law where most citizens do not understand their most basic and fundamental rights. I mean, I really got started with Flex Your Rights back in really kind of like post 9/11. Incidentally, where just, I would have friends of mine who would, talk about their, bad encounter with a police officer. And some of whom even, got busted with tiny amounts of pot, for example. And the, the theme that I found that just kind of like bothered me was that most people, just about everybody in this situation, at some point wound up giving up their constitutional rights without even knowing it. And I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a law student, but this is just like this one little piece of the law that I knew and that I understood. And I found myself giving these know your rights talks over and over again to my baffled friends who were surprised to learn that if police pull you over in your car, you're not required to let them search you. You can say, no, officer, I don't consent to any searches. Am I free to go? And I'd give this over and over and over again. It slowly just sort of became articles. And everything I did was always vetted by lawyers because everyone thinks that you have to be a lawyer in order to be able to understand your most basic constitutional rights. But that's not so. And so that's really where sort of the gem of the idea for Flex Your Rights came in, is finding areas within the law that people didn't understand, but then could be, you know, explained in very simple lay terms. And with jury nullification, it really dovetailed perfectly with what we were doing. By, you know, this point, we've pretty much covered almost all of the scenarios, including the Bearcat scenario, about how to handle various police encounters. If you're pulled over in your car, knocking on your door, or you're even stopped on the street, a sort of NYPD stop and frisk style thing. And one of the things that, you know, that I found that a lot of people asked about is, well, have you considered jury nullification? And this is a topic that I had become familiar with when I was an intern at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., the libertarian think tank in D.C. It was 1999, I believe. And I had seen a panel with Clay Conrad, who is the, you know, I would call the godfather of jury nullification.
Yeah, he wrote the book on the subject. I think that he's exactly the guy who wrote the book that you should read on it.
Exactly. He wrote Jury Nullification, Evolution of a Doctrine. And he was actually on the panel too. And so, you know, I saw this panel, I was inspired by it. And I always remembered it, so I knew about jury nullification for this time. And so as I developed these Know Your Rights resources and our two popular videos, you know, it was one of those ideas that people frequently asked us, and she suggested, have you considered doing jury nullification? So just the idea has been gathering, you know, force and gravity in my own mind. And now, you know, we're now putting it into action as we develop this what will be our third film.
Now, I think most people listening to this program know what jury nullification is, but just for the sake of completeness, can you give a quick layman's definition of what it is?
Oh, sure. Jury nullification is every juror's prerogative to vote not guilty, you know, during your criminal trial, even if you believe that the facts of the case have been proven. You know, this is something that every juror, you know, the prerogative that every juror has dating back to, you know, the signing of the Magna Carta, which basically guaranteed that citizens get to decide what rules they're going to, what laws they're going to live under. So, you know, even if the judge informs you in the jury oath that you are only allowed to consider the facts of the case and not the law itself, the truth is, jurors have this power to vote not guilty if they believe the law is either morally wrong or they simply believe it's being misapplied in this particular case.
Now, when you say that jurors have this right, now I understand that traditionally under the Sixth Amendment, it seems like people at the time of the Bill of Rights took for granted that a jury trial involved jury nullification. That was just what the definition was. It included this power. And you can find a lot of the founding fathers who believed in it and so on. But when you say that today jurors have these rights, is it really a matter of they have these rights and they're not aware of them, or these rights have actually been taken away from Americans?
It's a little bit of both. It's so interesting. This is one of these things where once you see it, you can't unsee it. You know, once you learn, you know, you read, you know, Clay Conrad's book, you learn about the history where, you know, you have, you know, quotes from the founders, where essentially they're saying straightforward that, you know, this is the power that citizens have. The founders of the Constitution basically said very straightforward, like, of course, the power of the jury is the power to determine the law itself. This is the basis of the Bill of Rights. And it was well understood by them. It was something that wasn't even questioned or really debated at all, but over the years, something, you know, happened where it was sort of slowly taken away. And really the case that, you know, that really kind of really enshrined this challenge for jurors was the Sparf case, I think, in 1895, which basically ruled that judges weren't required to inform jurors of their rights. It didn't mean that they weren't allowed to, or that jurors no longer had this power. It simply said that judges were no longer required to do this, but the practical impact of this was that judges did not allow any discussion of this whatsoever. And so you have this situation where jurors have this power, but the courts essentially ruled that the jurors kind of have to come almost pre-installed with jury nullification 1.0 before they come in, because they can't count on the judges or even the defense counsel to inform them about this right. And so it's been sort of this secret dormant power that jurors need to know and understand that they can't be punished for their verdict, and they have this power, but they have to know it before they come in. And so it's sort of this strange duality that exists. And that's where, you know, that's where Fletcher writes, that's where folks like BJA, Fully Informed Jury Association, come. It's like, you have to know this stuff before you go in, before you know, when you receive your voir dire, you have to be ready to know about this power, because you can never count on the government, you can't count on the prosecutor, you can't count on the judge, you can't even really count on the defense counsel, because they may have been barred or essentially threatened by the judge, who may not even allow them to make a jury nullification argument if they even know how to do it, because they're probably not taught about this even in law school, which is a scandal in and of itself.
But isn't it actually even more than that? Because isn't there this common joke that if you want to get out of jury duty, all you do is just tell the judge that you believe in jury nullification, you'll be out of there. Doesn't that mean then that, let's say I'm some guy who I show up for jury duty and I right. fully intend to employ jury nullification. If I use those words jury nullification during deliberation with other jurors, does that invalidate what I'm saying? Does it in fact mean that we've had a hung jury? Like, what does it mean? I mean, am I allowed to say that? Or if I wanted to engage in jury nullification, would I have to do it in a sneaky way? Would I have to say, well, I don't think I trust that witness, and then just belligerently refuse to trust that witness, and then they can't convict?
Yeah, this is, again, this really does get to the heart of sort of some of really, and this is something we will portray in our, you know, in our film, which we'll simply call Jury Duty, where we'll show, our hero character will have to get through this voir dire. I mean, first and foremost, like, part of being a jury hero, in a sense, is just understanding that this is an important power that you have. And so there's this prevailing myth that exists among the population that essentially, if you get on the jury first and foremost, that is proof that you're stupid. Because only stupid people get on juries, because they only pick stupid people. Well, this, in a sense, has perhaps become a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. And so the first thing to do if you're trying to be a hero is you want to decide, like, that this might very well be and probably will be the most important and powerful political position you will ever have in your entire life. And so once you see that jury summons is rather not just this annoying inconvenience where you're going to have to go to this place, it's going to be a lot like going to the DMV. It's not going to be glamorous, but you are, if you get on that jury, going to be the most, you know, powerful person in that room. Once you get that idea, I think all these other things can fall into place. For example, yes, during voir dire, if you say during the jury questioning, the selection process, I believe in jury nullification, you will be struck from the jury immediately. The prosecutor will immediately remove you. And so if you're going into this trying to figure out a way to avoid jury duty, yeah, sure, go in there and give a speech about jury nullification. You'll be removed from the jury. But then you'll also be removed from something very important, which is the opportunity to potentially set somebody free who is the victim of a malicious prosecution against someone who has broken, a bad and immoral law. And so once you get to that position where you understand the power, and as a juror, you want to get on the jury, yes, you have to keep the words jury nullification to yourself. And this is something Clay Conrad really gets into, the sort of the details of how to do this. And it's interesting because the idea is for people, among people who understand jury nullification, a lot of them have this misconception that there's no way that a person of conscience can get themselves on the jury without outright lying. But it's not so. Now, certainly there's going to be some facts about you that if they ask you directly, for example, have you ever been, you know, convicted of a felony? And if you have, well, first of all, you probably wouldn't even get the jury summons because, you know, you get that from the voting rolls. But you know, if you've been convicted of this crime, you might want to reveal that. But it's not your job to volunteer the nature of your conscience during voir dire. And so it's not your job to tell them, well, you know, I'm part of the, I don't know, the 58% of citizens, according to the latest Gallup poll, that think marijuana should be legal, for example. You don't need to say that, even though they're trying to weed out those people, no pun intended, if it is a marijuana case, for example, or a medical marijuana case. And so it's very important to not reveal the full extent of your conscience. Say as little as possible. Don't volunteer anything you don't need to volunteer, and let them do their job. And if at the end of the day you're on that jury, you're now in a very different place. You now have this esteemed role. You have more power in that courtroom than the judge, than the lawyers, than anybody else. And it's not, you know, as a member of a jury, you're not just, you know, a member of sort of this, it's not just a democratic system. It's part of the democratic process. But a single juror can veto the jury decision if they want to. And that's a really powerful and important part of the responsibility of being a juror. And this idea that you simply are judging the facts of the case is nonsensical. I mean, there's a great quote by Alexander Hamilton where he says, you know, jurors should acquit even against the judge's instruction. If exercising their judgment with discretion and honesty, they have a clear conviction the charge of the court is wrong. Tom, I mean, it's, and so this is very plain spoken. You have this power, and once you are on that, in that jury, now, once you're on the jury, you probably don't even want to say jury nullification inside the jury room unless you sense that other jurors are feeling the same way. But if you're the only one, you know, and someone's life is on the line, your best practice, if you will, in doing this, I would argue, is to just say not guilty. I mean, you can try to argue, if you want to argue a reasonable doubt defense, you know, and sort of play on some of the themes that hopefully the defense counsel may have brought up, and just say, I don't think they proved the case. I don't trust, you know, the government's witness who is basically paid off with their life so that they could get a better deal with the prosecutor. I mean, it varies from case to case, but, you know, you don't want to say jury nullification in that case because it's possible that you could be struck from the jury in that situation. It's unlikely, but it's possible. But you certainly don't want to bring up jury nullification at any point during the voir dire if you have an interest in getting on that jury and ultimately deciding whether you think the facts have been proven and if you think the law itself is moral.
Well, that passage you quoted from Alexander Hamilton slightly makes up for all the awful things that Hamilton did, and I always appreciate seeing that you can find nuggets of wisdom anywhere in this world. But let me raise an objection that you might get, because, of course, you know that there are people who are indifferent about jury nullification, people who support it, but there are people who are dead set against it. Over their dead bodies are they going to let this principle be vindicated? And some of those people are going to play dirty pool with you. And they're going to raise scenarios like, for example, a case involving a black man getting lynched and a white jury that thinks that the law against lynching is an immoral law. And so they're not going to vote to convict. And to the contrary, they're going to engage in jury nullification. And this just goes to show that this type of power cannot be entrusted to the common man.
Right. Well, first off, I'll say, make sure you check out the transcript or the full video of the panel, because the ending was the best part when the Q&A came up and a former judge brought up this exact same, you know, this same concern. So make sure you check out the article called How Jury Duty Accelerates the Drug War's Demise. You'll see it on our website.
We'll link to it in the show notes. Yeah, we'll link to it in the show notes.
Great, great.
Yeah, okay.
The response I have to that is, first of all, it's important to see jury nullification or jury independence. It's part of the process. It's part of the process where, you know, you have a situation where the police officers in the criminal justice system have discretion over whether they make arrests or not. The DA and the prosecutor themselves have discretion over whether they, you know, what charges they make or don't even make. And then the judge has, of course, his or her own discretion. Ultimately, the jury is the last level of discretion. It's part of the process. Yes, some juries will abuse this. There's no doubt about it, just like prosecutors can abuse their power. But we don't talk about taking away the government's power because they can misuse their discretion. Yet why are we scapegoating juries who have this power? And so, but ultimately, it is the jury has this role. And so whether you like it or not, in a sense, jurors do have this power. Moreover, this is something Clay Conrad really talks about, where he actually like really goes right after like what was going on in the South. If you have a situation where you have a racist society, you have racist police, you know, who aren't even making these arrests, and you have a racist judge, a racist prosecutor, and if you're talking about like the Emmett Till trial, for example, which is one of the most egregious, you know, murders of a young black man by racist whites, you had the police were acting on behalf of the defense rather than the prosecution. And so it's like, and then of course you have an all-white jury, and really the one single obvious reform you can make sure you have that would prevent a race-based verdict like this would simply make sure you have a jury that is reflective of the race of the people in the population. And so if you have an all-white, you know, jury in a racist society, you will never, ever be able to have justice. But to blame it on the jury is really, it's just disingenuous, you know, at best. And, you know, the thing with juries is they're easy to scapegoat because it's not like there's, like, jury guilds or anything like that. I mean, there's groups like FIJA, but for the most part, the jury, after the verdict, they scatter. And then usually the prosecutor, if they didn't win the case, what do? They blame the jury. And in many cases, I mean, you look at the facts of the case and there maybe was reasonable doubt. And so it's always very easy to scapegoat the jury. But when you have a jury in an apartheid state, in a racist state, and you're coming from this community where the police are basically in on it, the prosecutors aren't prosecuting people who lynch people, and you have a racist judge, you can't possibly expect to have anything other than a racist outcome. And so I would argue that there's a lot of jury scapegoating. But now I think when you're looking at it, it's a process where juries are allowing for a certain amount of clemency. I mean, after all, presidents have the power to pardon people. Why shouldn't we allow or respect the jury's role as part of this pardon process, as part of this process of mercy, of allowing a jury to decide that, you know what, in this case, it just doesn't, this looks like self-defense. But the judge will say, no, you must vote according to what the law is, and you have no sense. And we have cases where jurors, after they've sentenced someone to serve, you know, what ultimately became a 10-year, 15-year mandatory minimum sentence for a minor place, if anything, in the drug conspiracy. When they're asked about this by the members of the family, the press, they are shocked to learn the length of the sentence. And they say, well, I thought it was just going to be community service or something like that. I didn't think anyone would actually go to jail for this. And it haunts them for the rest of their lives. And so it's so important that jurors going into these situations realize the power that they have, and ultimately that the verdict is their responsibility, but they're going to be told over and over and over again, you are not to consider the law itself, you're only to consider the facts. And if the jury, you know, sends a note to the judge asking, you know, what's the likely sentence of this, you know, going to be, the judge will send back, you know, a letter saying, like, you are not to even consider
right.
The penalty. That is my job. You know, I'm the judge. Your job is to simply consider the facts, you know, yes or no. Was the crime committed? Yes or no. And that's scandalous, I think. I mean, when jurors are expected to already have to know this beforehand, that they have this power to disregard the law, and when you have judges telling them, essentially implying in a sense that if they don't do it right, that they're doing something wrong or perhaps even illegal. I mean, there's the situation with with Rich Paul, who was distributing marijuana in New Hampshire. And he essentially went in with a jury nullification defense. And it was interesting because there was a camera person afterwards who saw the jurors coming out and asked one of them, you know, how do you feel about your verdict? How do you feel about your verdict? And the juror said, well, I didn't have any choice. You know, I wasn't going to break the law, implying that if he, the juror, had voted not guilty, that he'd be breaking the law. I mean, that's really twisted. You know, and sure enough, you know, the judge, you know, made it very clear in that case, even though the defense counsel was allowed to mount a jury nullification instruction, these jury oaths and these jury instructions that the judges give hold the most sweat because they're the ones that the jury looks to for instructions.
Well, listen,
and
Steve,
ultimately that,
I want to make sure we get to the New Hampshire law before I have to let you go.
Oh, yeah.
I want you to tell us, what does the New Hampshire law say and how does it change things? And then before you go, I want to know, when's your movie going to be ready, because I want to have you back on.
Okay, sure. So the New Hampshire law, in the transcript, in the video, Tim Lynch from the Cato Institute, who's a mentor of mine, really, really goes into great detail about this. But for basically, long story short, is this. The New Hampshire law is very good and it's important. It says, in all criminal proceedings, the court shall permit the defense to inform the jury of its right to judge the facts and the application of the law in relation to those facts and controversy. And this is a big deal. This New Hampshire law is different, and it's, you know, probably stronger than, you know, all the others. It's the only state where there's a recognition of this as being respected in some way. And so the question is, how's this law been working? And it's been working. Part of it is we don't really know how well it's working, but from what we do know, it's not always working, because sometimes judges will say, this case is not a jury nullification case, and so therefore the defense counsel is not permitted in this case to use that argument, because this is not a jury nullification case. And that's one situation. And so what happened in the Rich Paul case, and I believe that's actually what happened in the Rich Paul case. And that is now pending appeal. And so we'll see what happens with that. But in other cases, the judge will allow the defense to use the jury nullification defense. But then, before the jury retires, the judge will issue the final instruction and make it very clear that your job is actually to only judge the facts of the case and not judge law. So they're essentially saying, like, yeah. The defense lawyer said, like, all this stuff about jury nullification and this, that, and the other thing, but here are the real rules.
Oh, man.
And I think, yeah, and so that's what's happened. That is what's happening. That's how some judges in New Hampshire are interpreting this law, totally flying in the face of the spirit of it. And so it remains to be seen what will happen with the New Hampshire Supreme Court. But either way, like, I agree with Tim Lynch on this. I'm optimistic because if the higher court slaps that down, ultimately, I guess that would invalidate the ruling for Rich Paul. But even if the higher court judge says that was okay, then I would hope that the New Hampshire legislature would look at that and say, wait a second, that is exactly what we intended to not happen. We need to redo this law and to make it tighter and stronger.
Right, right, right. Maybe that'll be the outcome. Now, so tell me when this jury duty movie, because I told people in the introduction about the other DVDs you guys have, but this jury duty movie has me interested. When's this going to be ready?
Tom, right now we are in that place called development.
Oh, okay.
We're in development right now, so I have not set a release date. I've burned myself before in the past saying that our movie is going to be done by this date, and then we blow, all these complicated things happen, and then we have to keep pushing it, and people are screaming at me. So I'm just not doing that game anymore. I mean, it could take some time, but if folks want to keep updated on this, definitely follow Flex Your Rights on Facebook. Follow Flex Your Rights on Twitter, go to flexyourrights.org, and sign up to our email list. You have to kind of scroll down all the way to the bottom of the website, but you'll get there. But sign up to our email list, and you'll be among the first to know what's going on. We're going to launch a Kickstarter crowdfunding campaign sometime in 2014. I want to make sure that I get that right. Of course, do. And so I want to make sure that, you know, everyone who is interested in this is able to know about that. And any of those three ways, or using all of them, will ensure you that you will be among the first to know about when the movie will be ready.
Well, Steve Silverman, I really appreciate your time. I'd like to have you back on sometime in the future before the movie comes out to talk about some of the topics covered in these other DVDs, which sound quite interesting and I think would be valuable for the listeners. So thanks again for your time.
You got it, Tom. Thank you.
All right, everybody. My thanks to Steve Silverman. Please check out my educational page that I made up for Mark Levin. It's libertyclassroom.com/Levin. Check that baby out. I haven't checked my calendar yet as to who's going to be on the program next week, but I know it's going to be awesome. I keep lining up guests and saying, this one's great, this one's great, this one's great. So I'm sure next week's going to be great. Make sure and help us keep the lights on here in our little Tom Woods Show office at no cost to yourself by entering Amazon from our little Amazon widget at tomwoodsradio.com. I really appreciate you guys doing that. It helps me keep my little office where I'm able to make these programs in peace and quiet. Another week of programs is behind us. We'll see you next week. Thanks, everybody.
The Tom Woods Show. In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans.
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You've found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 314. I'm talking to James Babb today about a campaign for jury education that he's helping to propel in New York City and beyond. We want to let people know about their rights to engage in jury nullification. Very important topic. Jim Babb, by the way, you may know for a lot of reasons, but one of them is WeWon'tFly.com, an anti-NSA campaign from some time ago. That was his project as well. And it's my pleasure to welcome James to the program right now. James Babb, thanks for being here.
It's great to be with you.
I want to talk about the jury nullification of, in effect, juror education campaign that's taking place thanks to the donations of concerned citizens everywhere. First of all, tell me, where is this happening before we get into the nuts and bolts of what you're telling people?
Okay, this is a education campaign to inform the general public about their rights if they're selected for jury duty. And this campaign is focused around the courthouse in southern Manhattan at 500 Pearl Street. It involves kiosk advertisements that surround the courthouse, as well as a pamphleting campaign to distribute leaflets on the sidewalks.
All right. So it's not exactly a coincidence that you would concentrate your efforts in a place like that. And that's why, no doubt, I saw a headline, well, this was from late 2013 with a similar effort, saying that jury nullification campaign sparks free speech debate. And I, and Jim, I thought to myself, why doesn't it spark a jury nullification debate? Of course, naturally, they don't want that. But why is this a free speech issue in particular?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, because of what we're talking about is extremely powerful information, and it's a threat to those that are trying to run the justice system as some kind of assembly line directly into jail. Because what we're doing is we're letting people know that if they're selected for jury duty, they have the power to judge the law itself, not just the facts of the case. So if a law is unjust or if it's being misapplied, the juror can say, yeah, you know what, I think he did smoke a joint, but so what? I don't think that's a legitimate crime. There's no victim. So I'm going to say not guilty. Now, if you're a prosecutor, this is the worst thing in the world. I mean, they control everything else. They've locked down the entire procedure from beginning to end, but there's this one little part they can't control, and that's an informed juror with their conscience. So, you know, a lot of courtrooms have even forbidden discussion of jury nullification. They say, oh, no, you can't talk about, you know, if you mention that, you'll get a contempt of court, despite the fact that it is a centuries-old tradition, completely legal. The Supreme Court's ruled on it. It's indisputably legal and appropriate to for a juror to do this, but it sort of upsets their apple cart.
I mean, you can trace it back through American history, through the just the understanding of what a jury trial meant. The very definition of a jury trial and a jury involved the idea that you could indeed judge not just the facts of the case, but the law. In the show notes for this episode, what number is this? This will be episode 314. So it'll be tomwoods.com/314. I'll link to a couple of episodes where I've talked about this subject. People can get some of that background. But you're right. It's not like James Babb thought this up in the year 2014, 2015. This goes back. This is part of what it means to be American. Now, does this free speech aspect of the question have to do with the following? Are they saying it's one thing for Mr. Babb here to have his thoughts about jury nullification and talk about it to his friends, but to be putting up signs that are right outside a courthouse, that's obviously meant to get jurors to actually act on his crazy ideas. That's going too far. Is that what they're saying?
Well, some might make that argument. In fact, Professor Julian Heichlin was actually charged with jury tampering for passing out pamphlets at that very courthouse several years ago. And he was facing very serious charges. They said, the statute basically says you can't give written communications with the intent of influencing a particular jury or on a particular case. And it was ruled on by the courts, and they said, well, passing out pamphlets and reaching out to the general public is not trying to influence a particular case. And it is, they decided that they graciously allowed us permission to pass out truthful information on a public sidewalk. So,
did you guys have any concern in light of what happened to him? Did you have any concern about the type of campaign you were engaged in that you might get into trouble? I mean, after all, when it comes to a billboard or something on the side of a, you know, a bus thing or whatever, the city had to approve that. So presumably you had a little bit of a buffer.
You know, I don't know. I don't think the city has any say in those ads. It's a private advertising company that owns those kiosks.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. So no, they did not. In fact, the approval process took place very quickly to lead me to believe that was not, that there wasn't a bureaucracy in place. We've done these campaigns in other cities where they do have to be approved by like a transit authority or something. And that takes a lot longer and, can be a little more challenging, but, no, that's, you know, they went up quickly. What I'd really like is if, you know, the prosecutor gets kind of grumpy about it, because when we did this campaign in D.C. last year surrounding the courthouse there, a prosecutor complained to a judge during a murder trial or something. And the prosecutor said, Judge, you know, we need to exclude any jurors that saw those billboards out there. And so they're talking about it. Meanwhile, there's a Washington Post reporter observing the trial. And he's like, what? Billboards? What? So he goes out. They do Washington Post runs a picture of the billboard on the front page.
Yeah.
I'm like, yes.
I saw that. Well, tell us what's exactly on these billboards. Of course, in a billboard, you're not going to have a whole book on jury nullification. You just want to pique their interest. What are you saying on them?
Well, the main headline is jury duty. Know your rights. And Google jury nullification, or good jurors nullify bad laws. And, you know, and then there's more details if they stand there and read a few bullet points. But mainly I want them to do their own research, learn from themselves, find out about this centuries-old tradition.
Now, you're right that I've also been reading this in articles on this general subject, that inside the courtroom, people have been asked, jurors have been asked, have you seen these billboards? Have you been influenced by these billboards? Now, I wonder if I'm putting you on the spot by asking this, but suppose I'm a juror. I saw your billboard. I'm influenced by it. I want to engage in jury nullification if the circumstances call for it. And I've just been asked, have I seen the billboard? What should I say?
Well, I'm not going to tell somebody to lie, but, you know, if it suits your conscience, you know, I think it's perfectly fine to just shut up. I mean, you know, they have a lot of, they're going to ask you a lot of questions when you go up for potential jury duty. You know, are you going to believe whatever the police say, or will you obey the judge no matter what? Questions like that. I mean, I personally put those in the same category of, you know, do you have any jewelry hidden in the house that we might want to steal? Or are you hiding Jews in the attic? These questions, you can answer any way you want without, any kind of, you know, feeling like you're dishonest. If your intent is to prevent an immoral kidnapping, then, you know, you let your own conscience be your guide. But I think under most circumstances, just don't volunteer a lot of information during that process. Just sort of nod through the questions as best you can, you know, and just try to blend in. That's, you know, at least that's what I would do.
Let's get back to this jury tampering issue. You could be accused of jury tampering with regard to spreading information about jury nullification if you can plausibly be accused of trying to influence a particular jury. So this is a kind of a fuzzy distinction here, because if you're trying to influence jurors in general, that seems to be okay. But you can't influence this juror right here.
That's basically it. And, you know, and I sort of understand where they're coming from, you know, to have these types of laws in place. They don't want, you know, they want the entire process to go on inside the courtroom. And if we had a fair justice system, you know, that would be perfectly reasonable. So yeah, when I do these campaigns, I'm not trying to influence anyone in particular. A courthouse like 500 Pearl Street in Manhattan has got thousands and thousands of victims being processed through there. So there are so many cases this could affect. Victimless crimes are completely out of control in the system. The federal prisons are full of people, are just stuffed with people for drug laws or possessing, you know, maybe a firearm in the wrong location, or, I mean, you can be arrested for almost anything these days. So, there's really no need to worry about a particular case, because that is in that environment. There are so many cases that where we can have a potential to have an influence on.
Now, who exactly is behind this campaign? I know you raised some money privately, and there's been a lot of Bitcoin money that's been donated. But is there an umbrella organization that's organizing it?
Well, it's really a grassroots effort. With the help of George Donnelly, we're sort of building a platform called the Jury Rights Project. And people can get information about this project. It's juryrightsproject.com/NYC will take you right to this project. But the idea is to attempt to build more communities and get people spreading these types of campaigns in their own towns, amongst their own groups, within their own community organizations. And because that's really the only way we can get this information into the hands of everybody. So, yeah, the Jury Rights Project is a great source there. I've done a lot of work with the Fully Informed Jury Association. I also refer people there for more information, fija.org. They've got great materials, flyers that we can download, pass out, things like that. Excellent resources. So, but the funding is really been all grassroots. We used Indiegogo for this one, and Bitcoin, and most of the money, over half the money's come in from Bitcoin. This is about, I think we're well over 60 contributors now that have made this happen. So it's a bottom up campaign. And, you know, I think people are going to get their money's worth on this, because it's really starting to take off in the media. And if we can get a similar result that we had in D.C., you know, people are going to be reading about this all over the country.
And that's what's great about it. First of all, I'm going to link to everything you just said at tomwoods.com/314. It's a great idea because it does two things. First, it absolutely does educate people on this subject, because there'll be people who never even heard of this idea. It's sort of like Google Ron Paul. Once you do it, you say, okay, not only am I hooked, but now I demand to know why I never knew about this before. Why has this been kept from me? So that's great. But secondly, by placing them strategically in these ways, you are practically inviting controversy, and that's what we need to break through the media silence on this subject. I mean, you're generating your own publicity.
Well, and you know, don't tell the prosecutors this, but if they were smart, they will just ignore it.
Right.
Well, but I'm counting on them to help me with some of the Streisand effect. And if they, you know, the grumpier they get, and if they could complain about it, that would really do me a favor.
Well, that was so interesting that it turned out that that whole Washington Post article with the billboard on the front page got its start when a prosecutor said, "Hey, you know, don't you look at these billboards?" So the journalist thought, "Ah, billboards. Let me go look." So, I mean, apparently there are still some decent journalists in this country. Is it the same billboard in all the different, I mean, places? Are you imagining that people will just do their own thing? What's the idea here?
Well, the campaigns that I've been involved in, we started in D.C., we've done Phoenix, and now New York. There's similar messages on these billboards, a similar look. But people want to do the same thing in their own towns. They can, you know, use what I've done as an example. They could even contact me and I'd help them, you know, design artwork for a particular location. But every town has different types of opportunities, whether it's, you know, a subway, an illuminated subway sign or a train platform, or, you know, like these kiosks and on the sidewalk in New York. So, you know, the sizes are all different, the prices are all different, but there's a lot of opportunities out there.
Now, of course, people can do this in their own towns, as you say, but how about for somebody who's in New York City and wants to support you? This is an ongoing effort, right? They can make a donation.
Yeah. Yeah, there's if they go to thejurywrightsproject.com/NYC, it'll connect you to the Indiegogo page. And right now we're raising money for the month of February. January's been covered, but now we're going to try to extend it into February. And as long as there's interest and people want it to continue, it will continue.
Well, of course, it so happens that next week it's going to be, because as you and I are talking, it's January, is today the 7th? I haven't got my new 2015 calendar. It's the 7th, right. Normally I have a Charlie Brown calendar for every day, but this year my wife got me the Brain Puzzles calendar. I left it at home. But anyway, it's next week, I think next Tuesday, that the case begins for Ross Ulbricht, the alleged Silk Road operator. And what's interesting about that is that from what I've seen, the prosecution is actually concerned that the idea of jury nullification might throw a monkey wrench into their whole effort, because they're afraid of a jury nullification outcome in this case. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, you know, somebody forwarded that to me, and I thought that was very interesting, and it sort of it basically confirmed that this work is very important. And it's very normal for any prosecutor to go to the judge and say, look, I don't want this talked about. I don't want that talked about. I don't want the jury to hear about this. I don't want the jury to hear about that. And in the case that you're referring to, my understanding was that the defendant has, for instance, free market philosophy. You know, he's like a pro-freedom, free market philosophy. Nope, we can't talk about that. And we can't talk about, and they don't want to talk about the possible sentence that the victim is going to receive. I mean, the defendant, that the defendant is going to receive. So in this, so they send out these memos and say, look, we don't want this talked about. And that there was a memo that particularly, in that case where the prosecutor actually says, such arguments and evidence only serve to invite jury nullification and should therefore be excluded. So you can tell what's on his mind. They're like, wait a minute, if they find out a defendant is not the evil monster we're painting him as, or if they find out that we're going to send him to jail for the rest of his life, they might want, their conscience might might wake up. So let's not let that happen.
Now, do you think, by the way, that there is, I mean, is there a strategy here that you guys have? It's not just that we want to educate people, roll the dice, and see what happens. Is it that, is your thinking that if people actually do begin doing this in a number of high-profile cases, that the result could be that the system gets, well, the prosecutors get frustrated, and maybe the authorities take on fewer of these cases and harass fewer people to begin with? Is there a strategy you're working toward?
Yes, and in fact, that there's historical precedent for that. For instance, jury nullification was practiced in 1850 in response to the Fugitive Slave Act, where it became a federal crime, even in the northern states, to harbor a fugitive slave. Because jurors refused to convict, because that's a stupid law, and they refused to convict people for hiding slaves, basically they nullified the Fugitive Slave Act, and they said, well, okay, we can't enforce that. It's a waste of our time. Prohibition, the end of alcohol prohibition, a big part of that was the fact that juries refused to convict people for alcohol-related crimes. Finally, they're just like, okay, you know, how many times can we put all these people in a courtroom and then get a not guilty? It's a waste of time. So it certainly sends a message back up the food chain to the people making laws that, you know what, maybe that's a waste of our resources, and we should think about maybe crimes that actually have victims. So that would be a wonderful outcome if we could make it just impossible for them to get convictions for victimless crimes. That would be amazing.
Jim, let me ask you a personal question, if I may, and if this is out of bounds, I understand completely, but suppose you get a jury duty notification in the mail. The standard approach that most people take is, I don't want to do this, and I hope there's some way I can weasel out of it. Are you going to try to weasel out of it, or are you going to think to yourself, maybe there's somebody about to get screwed, and I might be able to help that person?
Well, I would definitely think the latter. I mean, let's face it, there's so many people that are just ground. Their lives are destroyed. Their lives are ground to hamburger in that justice machine, that I would certainly be looking for an opportunity to stand in the way of that. And if that means a few days, you know, taking off from other responsibilities, sit in a courtroom, I would see that as a big opportunity. I totally understand, though, when people get that notice, you must appear. You know, it's completely normal to say, no, I'm not.
Right, exactly. Yeah, how dare you? But we have to look past that. You know, offhand, I can't remember which guest it was, but I had somebody on who really was was kind of unhappy and impatient with people who were looking for ways to weasel out of jury duty and saying, you know, yeah, okay, well, look, we understand it's coercive and we obviously don't like that, but there's the possibility that somebody's life is about to be completely ruined. There's at least the chance that could happen, and there's also the chance that you could play a life-changing role for this person. So maybe we should think of it differently. I did get a jury notification notice about 2 or 3 months ago, and day after day, I was supposed to call in and see if I was needed. And this was the first time, thanks to this show, my own show educating me, this was the first time that I thought to myself, well, I'm not going to try to think of any excuse. And I've got a lot of excuses. We've got health problems and things that we got to deal with in the family. I could have probably gotten out of it, but I just called in every day legitimately to see if my number would be called. And it never was, but I was prepared to do it because of basically people like you reminding me that, you know, there are people's lives at stake here, and if it's a small sacrifice for me and a potentially big outcome for that person.
It really is, and if more people did that, a lot of lives could be improved dramatically. So let's hope people get that. And, you know, and if somebody really needs to get out of jury duty, just say jury nullification.
Yeah, that's right. There you go. You can make a statement and get out of it at the same time. Well, Jim, I'm going to link people to everything you've talked about, the Jury Rights Project, the Fully Informed Jury Association. I want people to donate to what it is that you're doing. I want to give people backgrounders on jury nullification. I want to link to previous episodes we've done on it. I've even talked to Judge Napolitano about it. He's a big supporter of it. That will all be at the show notes page. And if you haven't checked out my new show notes pages, by the way, they are a thing of beauty, and you're breaking my heart if you're not going there. So tomwoods.com/314. Every once in a while, we get a mobile device that won't bring that up. So in that case, do www.tomwoods.com/314, and that baby will come right up. Jim, best of luck in this project. I appreciate what you're doing, as we all do. Thanks for being here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, everybody. Before I let you run today, I want to go through very quickly what I plan to accomplish in the year 2015. And I'm doing this because I think some of you may find it interesting. You might be interested in some of these projects. But also, for those of you who will wind up listening to this episode much later on down the road, well, you'll be in a position to compare this ambitious list with how miserably short I wound up falling, although I actually don't think that's going to happen. I do think I should be able to get these things done, and maybe I'll be able to do some other things. Who knows? But this is what I'm hoping to do, and probably not a whole lot more than this. I have not included in this list my travel, although I do plan to be doing some travel. Of course, I'll be speaking in Houston January 24th, 2015, alongside Lou Rockwell and Ron Paul. You can get details on all my events at tomwoods.com/events. I'm also hoping that that Florida Atlantic University event for late February is going to be a go. We'll see. I have an event at Auburn University in March. I can't give you the details on that one just yet. In April, I have an event April the 9th at, let's see, where is that one? That's at American University in Washington, D.C. Then April 25th, we're hoping to work something out up in Montreal for you Canadian folks up there. Then in May, I'm going to be in Dublin, Ireland. I believe that's the 22nd. But the dates will be up at tomwoods.com/events. I don't think I put the Ireland one up yet because I don't have firm details, but it will be round about that time. So in case you are in Dublin, by the way, and you want to make sure you find out about that, shoot me a note, woods@mises.org, and I'll put you on my Ireland list. I'm using that only for the purpose of telling people about my events. All right, let's go and look at what I'm going to be doing in 2015. I released all this information, by the way, in my newsletter, the Tom Woods letter. I release that on a weekly basis, so that's a non-annoying frequency. You can subscribe to it for free at tomwoods.com. And the first item is I'm going to release another free ebook. This one is called 14 Hard Questions for Libertarians Answered. So I will announce that in the newsletter, the Tom Woods letter. Subscribe at tomwoods.com. And I'll try and remember to announce it here on the show. That should be coming out within the next few weeks, as a matter of fact. Secondly, I want to, although this will be fairly minimal because I won't have that much time, but I want to promote the 10th anniversary edition of my 2005 book, The Church and the Market. The new edition is coming out this month, and it is officially a 10th anniversary edition. So you are getting to be an oldster when your books are having anniversaries. So that's coming up, and I'm looking forward to that. It's got an extra chapter, some additional material, a new introduction, a much, much handsomer cover. I'm very, very pleased with this new packaging. And it really is an introduction to Austrian economics. That's what it is. It's the book to read between Economics in One Lesson and Human Action. Like, you know, what do you read in between there? I recommend, if I may, The Church and the Market. But I'm not Catholic, you say. Well, it really doesn't matter. You still basically get, I think, a good intermediate discussion of a lot of important issues in Austrian economics. So I'll be talking about that when it comes out. Then by late May, I beg your pardon, late May, I'm not stretching this thing out any longer than it has to be. Late March, early April, I will be finishing Western Civilization to 1493, or I beg your pardon, Western Civilization from 1493. Well, that was a typo in my newsletter. I've already done Western Civilization to 1492. It's Western Civilization from 1493. So 1493 up through the present. That's my third course for the Ron Paul curriculum at ronpaulhomeschool.com. So that will be done. So I'll have only one course remaining to go. If you are interested in these courses, by the way, you can get them at TomWoodsHomeschool.com. I will post some samples when I come up for breath, but I assure you it's good stuff. And you can get the whole program, K through 12, at RonPaulHomeschool.com. Make sure and use the link RonPaulHomeschool.com, because if you use that link, then I will send you, if you write to me and ask for it, I will send you a free 10-lesson bonus course suitable for junior high and above on the importance and foundations of liberty. So that's only if you join through RonPaulHomeschool.com. Of course, this is all different from my LibertyClassroom.com. That's a separate site. The courses there are completely different. I'm not allowed to offer the Ron Paul homeschool courses that I'm doing through my Liberty Classroom. But that's another thing that I'm doing in 2015. I'm adding two illustrious faculty members to LibertyClassroom.com, both of whom have been guests on this show. Bob Murphy, the economist, and Brad Berzer, the historian. And I think it's just going to be a dynamite site after that. So LibertyClassroom.com will be expanding in 2015, our third year in business. Then I'm going to take 4 months off from working on the Ron Paul curriculum. 4 months of not doing it. I'm going to do other things. I'm going to relax. I'm going to travel. I'm going to spend time with my kids, which I always do, but now I'll be able to spend even more time with them. Then I'm going to release a short free ebook on an undisclosed topic, but I'll just say it's an ebook that will help a lot of you guys. If you are, I'll give you a hint. If you're looking to start a blog, but it seems like too much work, you don't know how to do it. You want to start a website, but you don't know how to design a website, and it's too expensive to hire a designer. Or maybe you do want to hire a designer, you don't know which one to hire, whatever. Or if I have a website, can I at least earn enough money with it to at least pay the hosting expense? I mean, how can I do that? Let's just say this ebook on an undisclosed topic will answer all these questions for you for free and guide you through things like this for free and give you tips and suggestions on issues like this for free. So stay tuned for that. Of course, if you subscribe to my newsletter, you'll also get a notification when that free ebook is released. Then I'm going to launch the podcast Contra Krugman, a weekly podcast with Bob Murphy. This will take place in April because I can't do it until my Ron Paul course, Western Civilization from 1493, is finished. I'll continue producing this weekday podcast, The Tom Woods Show. If you are enjoying, by the way, please consider becoming a supporting listener at supportinglisteners.com, because that entitles you to the Tom Woods bag of goodies, which is getting bigger all the time. And of course, it entitles you to the Kindle edition of my brand new book, Real Dissent, A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. There's also an offer where you can get a free audiobook edition of that book. Whether or not you're a supporting listener, you can get a free audiobook version of that book with me reading it at TomWoodsAudio.com. Then finally, in August, I will begin work on my final course for the Ron Paul curriculum, the course on the U.S. Constitution. So that's pretty ambitious in terms of what I'm going to do, but it's going to make me happy to get these things done, and really to get this Western Civilization course done. Oh my goodness, am I going to be able to breathe easier in a few months. All right, a couple more great topics coming this week. Bob Murphy's going to come on, and believe it or not, we are going to talk about the roads. So that's that for today. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.
All right, let's talk to Judge Andrew Napolitano right now. I'm going to be asking him your questions, the questions you guys submitted over on the Thomas E. Woods Facebook page. You all know the judge. He is the senior judicial analyst at Fox News. He's the author of numerous books, most recently Theodore and Woodrow, How Two American Presidents Destroyed Constitutional Freedom. Judge Napolitano, thanks so much for being here on our 100th program.
Well, I'm thrilled to be with you. Whether it's 100 or 1,000 or one, you're doing the work of human freedom, and I'm happy to play a small part, Tom.
Well, thanks, Judge. I got so much excitement generated among my listeners when they heard you were going to be, because I've been playing with them. There's a mystery guest coming up for the 100th episode. That was mainly because I hadn't known if I could book you or not, so you were the mystery guest. Now you're rock-solid guest. So they
the mystery is revealed.
That's right. So they submitted some interesting questions that I just want to throw at you and get your thoughts, okay?
Sure.
You and I have talked about this before, but inevitably when I mention your name, people are curious about what you think about jury nullification and if and how it can be used in the present day.
Well, there's many published opinions affirming jury nullification. I shouldn't say many. I know about a half dozen. I'm a strong believer in it. There are some states, New Hampshire, for example, that expressly permits it. In fact, in New Hampshire, the defendant is entitled to an instruction to the jury from the court. You may nullify if you want, meaning if you think that the government has applied the wrong law or if you think the defendant did what the government says he did, but it shouldn't be illegal, you can find him not guilty. And there are other states where state court opinions prohibit jury nullification. But to me, jury nullification is one of the last peaceful barriers we have from the tyranny of the executive branch, and I wholeheartedly endorse it.
So you think it's a situation where if you're in New Hampshire, you can openly use it, but in other states, because there's no
well,
open
you need to know the you need to know the law that of the state that you're in. I only know about New Hampshire because it is well known that New Hampshire permits this in the Constitution. In some states, there are opinions of the Supreme Court of the state prohibiting it. In some states, there are no opinions. It's really going to be up to the trial judge. In some states, the opinions are equivocal. They, you know, you really have to finesse how you're going to apply them. But most trial judges, unless they are serious small government people or libertarians, are against this because they view it as taking the role of the judge away and putting it into the hands of lay people. Having been a trial judge, I can understand that. But my sense of values are more towards the history of individuals standing up to big government, and the jury is one of the last peaceful ways to do that.
Now let's flip this on its head and ask, what about, this is another question somebody had, what about you as a judge and your career as a judge when you're dealing with a case in which the law that's at stake is one that you don't agree with or you think is wrong on one level or another? How have you handled that as a judge? Do you have to just leave that outside the courtroom?
Sometimes you do. It depends on how much of your system is aggravated by it. You can simply recuse yourself. The decision to recuse, that is to remove yourself from the case, is not appealable. The decision not to recuse is appealable, but the decision to recuse is not appealable. And not only is it not appealable, but you don't have to give a reason. So in New Jersey, I regularly recused myself from cases involving abortions because I just simply could not bear to sign an order authorizing an abortion, nor could I sign an order stopping it, knowing it was going to be reversed immediately, and I was just wasting everyone's time and effort and money, so I simply recused myself from it. Sometimes you hold your nose and do the right thing according to your oath, which is to uphold the law as it is, not as you want it to be. So you have that recusal stopgap. Occasionally, you can take a case where you disagree with the law and invalidate the law and just sort of roll the dice with the appellate court and see if they agree with you. But not every case presents the appropriate vehicle with which to invalidate the law. And if you invalidate the law knowing you're going to be reversed, again, you've just wasted everybody's time and money.